You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Bonjour and welcome to our super weekly podcast here at Corner House. I'm Sarah Perks, Programme and Engagement Director, and I'm joined by my usual partners in crime, Mr. Andy Willis and Miss Rachel Haywood. They will be talking about Latin American horror films in a very short while. However, our major focus is the stunning new exhibition, New Cartographies, Algeria, France, UK. That opens today, Thursday the 7th of April, and we'll be interviewing several of the artists involved. Of course, we'll have your What's On and a recommendation of the week, and not forgetting our fun quickfire film round. So first of all, let's hear from one of the major artists in our New Cartographies exhibition. It's leading contemporary visual artist, Zineb Sadira, and she did a solo exhibition here in 2004, and her career has really gone from strength to strength ever since. Curator Ed Welch caught up with her during the installation.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story behind your film?
Okay, so the film I'm presenting here is really, the point of the film was to kind of give visibility to an archive, which is really little known in Algeria and outside Algeria, really. And it's photographs taken by Mohamed Kwasi, who was the only Algerian photographer who photographed the Algerian War of Independence and the aftermath of the independence. He worked for the Ministry of Information at the time, but having said that, although he was given missions to work and do some particular, photography, at the time he was also doing a lot of photographs for himself. So a lot of his photographs are photographs of politicians of the time that then became very important leaders in the politics of Algeria, and then also photographs of refugees, photographs of colonial Algeria, so orphans, refugees, people at the Maquis, fighting. So what's interesting about this archive is that all the images we know from that period really comes from the French, often from the French army, if not from the French army, from the reporter, the journalists, European journalists who were allowed by the French to come to Algeria to photograph, but often from one only angle, the French angle in some ways. So he's interesting because he's taken photographs that we don't know of, with an angle that we very rarely see. So for me, it was very important that, obviously, Mohamed Kwasi died in 96, and he left this amazing black and white archive to his wife. And his wife, Nasafia Kwasi, who's 86, is really struggling with the weight and the responsibility of that archive, obviously, because photographic archive means negatives, and negatives are actually very sensitive to look after. And obviously, a lot of them are more than 50 years old. So, they're kind of deteriorating by the minute, really. So, I've seen perhaps 300 or 400 photographs. For example, he's taken photograph of Frantz Fanon, the funeral of Frantz Fanon because he was buried in Algeria, photograph of Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, Lubumba, all those very important revolutionary that came in Algeria in the 60s because, as you know, Algeria in the 60s was the hub of all the revolutionary groups. So he was part of that. But, of course, the biggest part of the photography is, 54 to 62.
Why do you think that the archive hasn't found a home in an institution, in a library or a museum?
Well, if you know Algeria quite well, you wouldn't be surprised because Algeria is not very good at looking after its heritage, really, when it comes to buildings or craft or anything, really. But also because these photographs were taken at the time, he was officially, as I said earlier, working for the Ministry of Information, for the GPRA. As you know, in 62, when the independence came, there was a lot of different factions in Algeria who were fighting for the power, So the GPRA suddenly became less important, and perhaps some people didn't want to so much hear about that story. That's one idea, but I think mainly it's to do with the fact that there is no respect, really, for the history, even that history of revolution, really, and also for anything to do with Algerian identity or heritage, really. And you can see it, this case is not the only case, really. Very much the Algerian cinema, we've lost so many films through lack of conservation. And, Zensafia situation is one more case in that long list of cases,
How do we explain that, do you think, this lack of investment in national history, national memory?
I often explain it, I don't know if I'm right, but I often explain it as because Algeria was colonized for so long, and I really do believe that the Algerian, unlike the Moroccan perhaps, or the Tunisian, were the neighbors who were not colonized. the Algerian per se has got a problematic identity, or doesn't have a self-esteem or self-worth in the same way than perhaps others. That's why anything to do with scribe or the Algerian heritage is really been abandoned now and not looked after. And so I think there is something to do with that, you know.
What future does the archive have, do you think?
Well, at the moment, that's what I'm trying to do with Amina, because apart from doing the piece of work, which for me the main reason was to raise an awareness of the work of Mohamed Kwasi, and I hope this will work, it's Amina and I have taken on to actually talk and do presentation about the work, and we just came back from the Sharjah Biennale where we attended the March meeting where we talked about, you know, openly at a presentation about his work, and that was in order to find somebody who could give some funds to scan, because the first thing to do is to scan all the negatives, you know. I mean, it's early days, perhaps somebody will contact us. We've got few people who were interested, and we'll have to wait and see. But ideally, we want really the archive to stay in Algeria. But Safias Kwasi doesn't trust the Algerian government, even now, because she has seen, you know, over the years, and she knows very well the system. I think she's wrong. I think now Algeria might be just now able to do something about the archive, but she doesn't trust them, and, you know, it's fair enough, really.
The title of the work, Gardienne d'Image, is in the plural. Of course. Do you see yourself as a guardian of images?
Yes, I do pretty much, and I do believe that Safia is also, doing the interview in the piece is Amina Menia. So I really think that us three, you know. And for me, it's a gender kind of relation, because I think for me very much in Algeria, and I think it's true for all the Arab world, women are often the kind of the passer of the traditions. And for me, it was nice to kind of recall that, you know, that's kind of passing on of tradition. And in that case here, memory and stories.
Just on that, actually, why do you think women play such an important role as kind of transmitters of memory in Arab culture?
I don't know. I mean, I can talk for Algeria. And why women? I'm not sure. I think because we grow up, we raise the children, therefore we tend to kind of teach them mostly. We are the teachers, really. And especially perhaps in the olden days when there was no school, the children were spending a lot of time with the mothers, you know. So there is this part. But Algeria is very particular because, you know, of its colonization history. You'd find a lot of people who haven't been to school. Like I'm thinking of my parents and my grandparents, because where they were living in the Aurès, in the village, there was no French school, no Arabic school. And if there was some, often the indigenous people were not allowed to attend them anyway. So because there was no written ways of telling stories, the oral history was very strongly developed. And I remember with my grandmother, particularly sitting when I was going on holiday in Algeria, my grandmother telling me stories, and then it carried on with my mother telling, and my mother will tell me the stories that her mother will tell her, etc., etc. So that's why me, when I had a daughter in 1991, I got really interested in this idea of transmitting. How do you transmit an identity, an Algerian identity, which has been removed now by two generations, the French and the Algerian one, because my daughter was born in England. How do you actually pass on the identity, the tradition, the knowledge, the histories, and the stories? So, you know, that's, for me, it's very much a kind of something that perhaps mothers do, you know.
You've talked quite a lot about the importance of oral storytelling, oral history, but images also clearly in your work play an important role. How do you see the role of the photographic image in that process of memory transmission?
I mean, you're very right. I think it's a visual story. So for me, it has as much worth as oral. It just, you know, with technologies, that type of stories came much later. But that's something that very, very much interests me in the same way as with film, for example. So it has an extremely important role. Often with the visuals, with the images, you need also perhaps the oral history. And I think that's quite interesting with the piece, because Safia is here sometime to tell us what the stories are, because Mohamed Kwasi is not here anymore. So she has a very important voice within that. And when she is gone, then what will happen? If nobody has recorded the stories behind each photograph, who's going to tell the story? Then for me, that's a big issue, and that's why I'm kind of really keen for somebody to do something about it. But I should just also add that another thing that interested me about this piece and about the story of Safia is that throughout art history, a lot of women who have had husbands, painters, photographers, etc., who were well known when they died, they often took on the job to keep alive the work of their husband, but always without any recognition and always in the shadow of their husband. So for me, it was important to give a voice to Safia, a bit more than just Mohamed Kwasi. And of course, obviously, in her case, it's a problem because she's so gentle and shy. But, you know, it's, for me, she's as important as him in some ways because he's gone. She's custodian of the images and she knows the stories behind them.
Great, thank you.
Art, film, books, food, drink, all at Corner House, Manchester.
Okay, on to this week's film focus. This week, it's Gustavo Hernandez's Uruguayan horror film, The Silent House, or in Spanish, help me here, Rachel?
La Casa Muda.
And the interesting thing about this is it's all shot in one take, or sort of, however. That's not actually possible, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, so to start us on this film focus, Andy, fill us in on Latin American horror, history and the genre.
Latin America has got quite a significant history of horror cinema. It's not one that's that well known, I don't think, in this country, but when you scratch the surface a bit, you find a country like Mexico, which has always been a major player in Latin American cinema. They've got a long history of horror making that goes back to the 30s. I would say the probably golden age was in the 1950s and 1960s when there was an array of quite stylish horror films produced in Mexico involving kind of suave vampires, witches, and some more local myths like the Crying Woman or the Aztec Mummies. So there's a whole range of different things. By the early 1960s, that kind of wave of the Golden Age, as I called it, of horror, is hijacked somewhat by the Mexican wrestlers, one of my favourites, as I'm sure some people know. And El Santo, the man in the silver mask, then was pitted against a whole range of people. In 1962, he fought the vampire women, and then in 1964, very oddly, he combated against a diabolical axe. Not something you get in that many films. And then by the 1970s, he joined forces with another of the wrestlers, the Blue Demon, and they fought both Dracula and the Wolfman in the same film. So a kind of mix there of like serious, arty, sophisticated horror films and quite exploitative ones. And then by the mid-1970s, that exploitative side is really what becomes associated with a lot of Latin American horror films. And again, led by filmmakers in Mexico, they produce lots of sort of rip-offs of American and European films. Probably the most famous director of that type of film is René Cardona Jr. His dad also made some of the wrestling films. And he, in 1977, made one of the great Mexican exploitation films, Tinto Herrera, which is a kind of Jaws ripoff with a crazy tiger shark stalking the sea around Mexico. And it starred Hugo Stiglitz, who people may be familiar with the name. Do you know the name, Sarah?
No.
Well, that was one of the characters in Inglourious Basterds.
Oh.
Tarantino took the name from one of the big stars of 1970s Mexican exploitation films.
I think possibly only you and him would know that.
Maybe. Now, of course, more recently, bringing it more up to date, the big name that kind of is the shadow over all Latin American horror cinema is Guillermo del Toro, the Mexican director, who really has become something of a sort of transnational or international figure, making films all over the world in different moments. There has, I think, under his influence, I think also under the influence of the recent success of a lot of Spanish horror films that have been released, a kind of new wave of Latin American horror films. Some of them have been on at Viva, some of them have played at cinemas in the UK. Kilometer 31 was a Mexican-Spanish co-production. The Appeared was an Argentinian-Spanish co-production. And Undertow was a Peruvian, Colombian, France and German co-production. I think showing the kind of economic potential of horror films internationally. So everyone's getting on the bandwagon of trying to make horror films. And I think this new film is kind of within that kind of drive, if you like. Also, there's a lot of underground filmmakers in Latin America who tend to cluster around a big festival in Buenos Aires called Rojo Sangre, Red Blood Film Festival. So there's a kind of underground horror making, and then there's this more international and overground horror filmmaking.
Okay, I give you an A+ for that summary. Thank you, Andy. Back to The Silent House. Rachel, you've seen the film. Now, I know how these horror things work. How much can you actually tell us what happened? Or how did it make you feel, anyway?
There's very little that I can actually say about what goes on in the film without revealing anything. But in terms of how this film makes you feel, it does make you jump. I was lucky enough to watch the film in Cannes last year, and it was definitely one that had a real buzz about it. The film was really celebrated by the critics and the audience who were there. So the director really does pare it all back to the essential elements. So you apart from a few road scenes, you're set mostly in the silent house, and we have just three main characters. I mean, the film is very much carried by the female character, very much leads the film, and it's a very powerful performance, very emotional performance, and there's a lot to compare The Silent House with films like Wreck, and with the inevitable comparison with Blair Witch as well.
Okay, Andy, tell us a bit about Wreck. You didn't mention that, actually, so I'm taking your grading down.
Well, Wreck, I have in my notes to mention Wreck later. Wreck is, I think, one of the things that it seems that's similar is the very claustrophobic atmosphere that Wreck brought. I think Wreck is one of those films, as I mentioned, that has influenced Latin American horror makers, and certainly those films made it by Barcelona Spanish horror filmmakers like Jaume Balagueró and Paco Plaza, who made Wreck, their other work as well with Filmax, the production company. I think they've been more internationally focused, and therefore filmmakers around the world have seen those films. But I think it's that claustrophobic, almost time unfolding in front of you kind of thing that is taken from Wreck to this film.
Okay, and then both of you tell us a little bit more about this one-shot take film thing. So we know that there's films that have been made allegedly in one shot, but perhaps, Andy, tell us how that really works, and then Rachel, tell us how it affected the experience.
Well, I think technology means you can do it more and more now, longer and longer takes. In the past, you would have to disguise the edits based around the length of a can of film and how long that would run in the camera. But now with digital technologies, you can have much, much longer takes than you used to be able to in the past. And I believe, you know, there's a number of films now that boast that they have been shot in one take. There's a British horror film called Cut, which tries to suggest it does the same thing. Whether or not they are, you don't really know, because often they're so skillfully hidden, if there are any edits, that you don't notice them anyway. But by God, to shoot a whole film in one take is one hell of a logistic nightmare, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's one big SD card, I would say. Rachel?
I think that, well, I know that there's a lot of debate online about whether this particular film really was done in one take. There's certainly opportunities in the film where it could have been edited. But regardless of whether it was really done in one take or not, it's certainly, in terms of affecting the experience, the lead actress really builds up tension very, very well, and you see a particularly strong evolution of character through the film. So you could probably understand that she may have done it in one take, because she unravels quite strongly.
So what's the relationship of this film with more kind of Hollywood standard horror films?
Well, I think you find that Hollywood, or certainly not necessarily mainstream Hollywood, but small American independent production companies, as well as the big studios, are always on the lookout for films that are innovative in some way, that reach an audience, and then they gobble them up and try to remake them. I mean, Wreck was remade as Quarantine in America, and I was amazed when I was reading about this film. I looked it up on the internet and started reading, and I was actually reading about the remake, the American remake, which has already been released. As far as I know, it's made by the two directors who made Open Water. So again, it's one of those things where you think, oh, well, maybe there'll be something in it. But as far as I'm concerned, you always go back to the originals, and they've always got something, that little bit extra that the Hollywood remakes haven't got.
Okay, so from both of your perspectives, Andy, you've not seen the film yet. Rachel, you've seen it. Why should our audience go and watch it?
Well, I would say, as we've been doing today, the fact of it supposedly being in one long take means lots of people are going to be talking about this film. And for me, I'll be going to see it because I want to be part of that conversation. I don't want to be kind of on the outside.
So you can join Andy in the bar on Friday. Okay, Rachel?
I'm not a massive, massive horror fan, but the film definitely had appeal for me. Again, like Andy says, it's that technical aspect, but it's more than that as well. It's about the character development, I think. I think that's and watching someone unravel on screen.
Ooh, okay, that's great. Very intriguing. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Let's move on to our quickfire round. Last week, long-time listener, first-time caller Rick sent us his answers to last week's quickfire round. So Andy's going to recreate them for us. So Andy, what was Rick's best fruit film?
Rick's best fruit film was one I was amazed none of us got, really, but that's because we're doing the quickfire round, which was Woody Allen's Bananas. I would say possibly a better choice than any of ours.
Quite true. What was his best film with virtually no dialogue?
And again, I think because he probably had a bit longer to think about it, but he came up with The Red Balloon, which again, a classic film with no dialogue or hardly any dialogue.
Yeah, that's a great one. And what was his best Vincent Gallo film?
Well, he tended to agree with us there, and he said, surely there hasn't been a great Vincent Gallo film.
Quite true, I think. Moving swiftly on to this week's teasers, Best Latin American Horror. I'm going to have, it's very obvious, Pan's Labyrinth. Andy?
Well, I mentioned when I was talking before El Vampiro, the Mexican film from 57. I would go for that one.
Okay, Rachel?
I need Andy's help to help me remember the title of the film that I want, but it's a Viva film from many years ago. I think it was a Mexican vampire film, but female vampire.
The Chilean one. Was it about like sort of gothic, goth-type vampires? Yeah. Eternal Blood, by the sound of it. The Chilean vampire film with a load of sort of vampire goths in Santiago.
In respect of our Algerian exhibition, New Cartographers, what is your best Algerian set or made film? Now, Andy's got two instead of Rachel having one, so Andy, you go.
Well, yeah, I wasn't sure, so I came up with one that's an Algerian film, and then obviously is set in Algeria, from 2004 called Viva Algeria, which is a really interesting film that looks at the lives of three women and their relationship between both the modern world and Islam. And I went because I thought, well, is it Algerian or set in Algeria? I went for Pepe Le Moko, the classic French crime film with Jean Gabin from the 1930s, which is nearly all set in Algeria.
I'm going to go for that neorealism classic, The Battle of Algiers. I'm sure most of you have seen it or at least heard of it. Moving on to best film in one take or one supposed take, I'm going to go for Russian Ark. It's a few years old. We showed it here. Really, really enjoyed it. Rachel?
Oh, no, I'm going to struggle with that one. In terms of one take, I don't know. In terms of lots of long takes, I'm not going to go for Rope. Too obvious. It's not good. But we did watch Turing Horse. That one was everybody's favourite film with lots of long
takes.
No, I'm
sorry. That was six long takes. I want one long take. You're going to have Hitchcock's Rope then, if you've got
it. It's not.
Anyway, Andy?
Well, even though Rachel disparages the choice, I was in fact going to go for Rope because as we were talking about technology and having to hide the edits, I think Hitchcock does quite a masterful job of hiding the edits. Well, they're not really out, zooming into the back of someone and then out, hardly hides it. But for the time, it was quite an innovative way of trying to construct a film that seemed to unfold in real time without any edits.
Okay, and we've got a bonus round this week. It's your best Uruguayan film, Rachel.
Okay, now this is my turn to get two choices. I would have to go for two films from Viva of last year. They were two of my highlights from the festival. One is Gigante, and the second is my top film of last year was Bad Day to Go Fishing, which was a really bizarre, quirky comedy about a European wrestler who is paid really to throw lots of fights and to take on local inhabitants of a small village so that his rather quite kind of oily, slimy boss could make a lot of money off the back of his wrestling star.
Andy, do you have one?
Well, again, most of my experience of Uruguayan films comes from Viva, and a few years ago there was a really charming film in Viva called Whiskey, and I will go for that.
Okay, I'm not doing one because it's just one step too far for me. Don't forget, you can send in your responses to our quickfire round via a medium of your choice.
You're listening to the Corner House podcast, available from www.cornerhouse.org.
Here's our What's On. That's our mini guide to Corner House and beyond, coming very soon. Do you like French caves, Werner Herzog films, or prehistoric art, but you hate 3D? Fear not, the German auteur's new masterpiece documentary can be enjoyed in a non-headache-inducing 2D, that's two dimensions, and yes, actually, it's better. Rachel and Andy, what do you think about 3D?
Well, I did think that 3D would be, again, I remember the days of Jaws 3D, and when 3D sort of was coming back, and then again it was coming back, but everyone seems to have invested so much money in it, now it's here to stay, I think, so I think we'd better get used to those glasses. But I still, you know, myself, I'm a bit old-fashioned and I still think it's still too gimmicky for me.
The film is called Cave of Forgotten Dreams and I just really hate 3D. I saw Toy Story 3D and I would just much prefer to watch it in 2D. Rachel, you've actually seen the film in 3D.
I'm going to echo you. I'm not a 3D fan. Andy, I can remember Jaws 3D as well. I remember being petrified when the shark swam past me. I had to take the glasses off so that I wasn't so scared. I actually had to take the glasses off again when I watched Cave of Forgotten Dreams in Berlin. So I've not got a good history with 3D. I think the film actually works very, very well in certain scenes in 3D, particularly, as you would expect, the cave walls and the cave paintings are particularly strong in 3D. The office scenes and the interviews of talking heads really don't need to be in 3D. So for me, I think the regular 2D version is going to be a real treat.
Great. So that's Cave of Forgotten Dreams. It's screening for this week only from Friday the 8th of April. Selected times on our website. And it's probably safe to say we're not going to be showing any 3D films anytime soon. Also on this week, outside of Corner House, it's Filmonic's Kino Cabaret. I reckon most of you are familiar with Filmonic. The name is actually Kino Film backwards, but we already have a Kino Film in Manchester, so when this was set up many years ago, they decided to call it Filmonic. It's a bi-monthly open mic night for regional filmmakers, but once a year they do a big cabaret. It's done around the world, and it started here during the Commonwealth Film Festival, and it's an intensive week where groups of filmmakers get into teams, get together, and make lots of short films with very little resources, but lots of enthusiasm and skill. There's been one screening already this week at the BBC, and the next one is this Sunday, the 10th of April. That's at 7:30, £5 tickets, well worth it to support this unfunded initiative. And that's held at the Deaf Institute. You can check out the website, www.filmonic.com, for more information. We've just announced our spring adult courses back at Corner House. I'll be co-hosting one of those courses, An Introduction to Art and Politics, with Dr. Joe, the curator of our current exhibition. And we're going to be looking at the relationship between contemporary art and contemporary politics, and looking at some of the issues that we've explored, such as the Middle East, North Africa, and also things like what's happened in post-relational aesthetics and how artists work with collaborative projects and groups of people and social issues as well. Obviously, I'd say that's the one that you should be attending, but also there's a couple of other courses. We have one on New British Cinema with one of our favourite lecturers, Roy Stafford. And also there is Redefining the European Auteur, jointly led by another two of our favourite course leaders, Carmen Herrero and Isabel van der Schelden. So to find out more about all of those evening courses, do go onto our website, and you could go direct to www.cornerhouse.org/courses. Now, our recommendation of the week, staff member Isabel Croissant, who is the programme manager for our creative industry strand, presents us with hers.
This week I'd like to recommend joining the Contemporary Art Society. I was aware of their existence. Basically, they're the network that supports and develops both art collection and individual art collector in the UK. But I discovered a lot more during the event they programmed as part of a guest network strand a couple of weeks ago. And I think it actually could be of interest to a lot of people who would not necessarily think it was for them. So basically at the guest network, we heard from an individual art collector, a gallerist and an artist. They talked about their work, what art collectings bring to them, but also more generally about ways to appreciate and understand contemporary art. And it was all in a very open and friendly way, which I thought was really good, as contemporary art can sometimes be perceived as inaccessible or scary. And this was a great demonstration of how the Contemporary Art Society demystifies the world of contemporary art to a certain extent, and really helps getting an understanding and appreciation of it. So what they do so by organizing loads of studio visits, curator-led exhibition tours, meetings with artists and galleries, private collection visits, and a lot of other things. It kind of also reminded me that as a Corner House member of staff, I'm quite privileged because we get to talk to all the artists and curators directly, and I personally found it was really helpful to understand and appreciate contemporary art. So, if coming to all the fantastic visual arts event we've programmed is not enough, I would really recommend joining the Contemporary Art Society to know more about contemporary art in a welcoming and open atmosphere. And who knows, it may even start you collecting it. So in terms of practicalities, if you want to know more and to join their Northwest membership, you can have a look at their website, which is www.contemporaryartsociety.org. It costs £50 a year or £25 if you're a student, and you even get a limited edition print when you join, so that's quite a bargain. So there you go, that's my recommendation for the week.
Thank you, Isabel. Okay, it's time to draw to a close. I hope to see you checking out our new gallery exhibition, New Cartographers, or perhaps quivering in your seat for The Silent House. As they say, don't have nightmares, do sleep well.
You've been listening to the Corner House podcast.